Our Torah portion this morning is called the Beshelach, and it begins in Exodus chapter 13 and verse 17. And I shared quite a bit about this passage already this morning during the Torah service, and I won't be reviewing all of those things, but a number of them I will be going over again as we go through this. And I know that last week I asked you to hold questions and comments. I hate to do that because you always ask such great questions and have great insights to share. But if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you to do that one more week. This is such important stuff that we're going through that I just don't want to possibly miss out on something for lack of time or get distracted off into something else. But next week we'll go back and we'll invite all your questions and comments once again. So please, if you don't mind, we're just going to hold those for a moment. I shared with you a few moments ago during the Torah service that this Torah portion, which begins with a battle and it ends with a battle, describes where we live. We live in a war zone and we walk between two enemies. The portion starts with the attack of Pharaoh and his army, and the Torah portion ends with the attack of Amalek. And God in this portion is describing spiritual warfare that every single believer, every single day of their lives must deal with. So I can't think of a more pertinent thing for us to look at than this. No other parts of the Torah will describe various issues we go through. It gives us commandments to give us guidance. It talks about things that God has done in the past. It talks about things God's going to do. It gives us his promises, his principles for life. But I can't think of anything more vital describing where we live from the day we're born to the day we die than Beshelach. This portion right here. Again, it begins with the battle. And it ends with the battle. And then between are testings. And what's interesting is in every one of these testings, Israel fails, but God never criticizes them. He never criticizes them until the last failure. When they say, is God with us or not? That he punished them for. All the other testings, you know, they came, here's Pharaoh and his army coming up behind them to attack, and they really blow that one. But he doesn't criticize them, doesn't correct them. And then they come to a place where they're thirsty and there's water, but it's bitter, and he has them throw the tree into the water and it becomes sweet. But he doesn't criticize them for their complaints, their whining. Then they get hungry, and they whine and complain some more. Wah, wah, all the time they're whining, and God doesn't criticize them. He brings them quail to eat. He brings them manna in the morning. And then they come to a place where there's no water at all. They're thirsty. They want something to drink. And they whine again. And so God provides water from the rock when Moses strikes the rock. Why doesn't he criticize them? There's an important principle you need to understand. And that is this. Failure has a very important purpose in our lives. Because you see, when you fail a test, it begins to destroy your ego. And that's a very, very important thing that needs to happen. It destroys the ego. But in the last test, they go too far. And they say, is God with us or not? Are you kidding? How do people even say that? He provides manna for them every morning. He provides fire at night in the pillar of fire. He provides cloud by day as they go through the hot sun. They've watched him perform all these miraculous plagues against Egypt. And the slave people have now come free at the cost of the destruction of the mightiest nation on earth. They've watched the Egyptian cavalry and chariots and horses totally destroyed as God parts the Red Sea for them to go across on dry land, and they ask, is God with us or not? That was going too far. And the very next thing that happens, they're attacked by Amalek. There's a little story, and if you have an Art Scroll Comish, it's recorded for you. And it says there in the commentary, there's a story. A sage came up with a story. He says it's like a little boy that the father carries on his shoulders. And every time the little boy asks for something, the father takes it and gives it to him. The little boy says, I would like that. And the father hands it up. Father, I want that. And the father hands it up. And he keeps giving the child everything he asks for. And as they go along, they come to a stranger, and the child asks the stranger, have you seen my father anywhere? I can't find him. And at that point, the father takes the child, throws him to the ground, and a dog comes and bites him. And that's Amalek. You know, we invite sometimes attacks in our lives because we fail to recognize God's constant presence with us. Shame on us. He's constantly supplying every need, every need. And pretty soon we just start thinking these things just happen. Is God even around? Yeah, he's doing all of it for you. He's doing it all. So, let's do this. Let's go to chapter 14. Chapter 14, and we're going to start with verse 10. One of the ugliest passages anywhere in the Bible. It's just ugly. Israel has come out of Egypt. Pharaoh thinks they've become entangled in the land. And Pharaoh's heart is hardened further, and he said, let's go get them. And so here the people of Israel are there right on the shore of the Red Sea. And then behind them now comes Pharaoh with his chariots and his cavalry. And all they can see is, we're going to die. Should we die by drowning or be hacked to death by Pharaoh's army? That's all they could see. They completely forgot God. And look what they say. Chapter 14, verse 10, Pharaoh approached. The children of Israel raised their eyes, and behold, Egypt was journeying after them, and they were very frightened. The children of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, were there no graves in Egypt that you took us to die in the wilderness? What is this that you have done to us to take us out of Egypt? Is this not the statement that we made to you in Egypt, saying, let us be, and we will serve Egypt? For it is better that we should serve Egypt than that we should die in the wilderness. That's an ugly passage. Ugly, ugly words. Immature and wrong. But I want us to analyze what they say, because I think you'll see yourself in this. I know I see myself. So let's analyze this phrase by phrase. It says they cried out to the Lord, and that's where they should have stopped. In fact, before they even cried out to the Lord, they should have remembered what the Lord had said. They should have remembered the promises that he had made to them and how he had proven himself to be true. But they forgot his track record. They cry out to the Lord, and then they say to Moses. Now, this is what's interesting. They cried out to God, but they attack Moses. You know, when you're mad at God, what you do? You attack someone or something tangible in your life. They turn their attack against something or someone tangible. I shared a minute ago that I have people who love me and care about me, but when they have a panic attack, when they get frightened, they'll say the most ugly and terrible things I've ever heard. And I realize it's not them talking, it's fear. Fear makes you say some ugly stuff. Fear makes you angry. Show me an angry person, I'll show you a fearful person. Fear causes anger. Ever have somebody just jump out of the bushes at night and go, boo? What's the next thing you do? You punch them in the arm. Don't do that to me. You know, it's just an automatic response. Fear causes anger. Angry people are fearful people. And note the mocking tone. Weren't there enough graves in Egypt? They deride everything that's been done. They forget everything that's been done. That you took us. Now, isn't this interesting? Moses hadn't taken them. God had taken them out. God, he took complete credit for removing them from Egypt. But now they limit it all to Moses. They have to blame somebody. They have to attack somebody. Why is it when we get afraid and panicky and angry, we think somehow attacking somebody makes it better? It doesn't. You took us out. God's left completely out of the picture. Because you see, one of the things we're going to learn as we go through this is that fear makes you very forgetful. Fear makes you very forgetful. You see, the people of Israel were trapped here between Pharaoh's army and the sea. And so they think God brought us here to destroy us. But earlier we read that God brought them there to destroy Pharaoh and his army. That's why they're there. They're not the enemy. The enemy is the enemy. But there's something inside of us. We feel so guilty or we feel so insecure or whatever that we just can't trust that God loves us, that God cares about us, that he really keeps his promises to us. We keep thinking, oh, we've messed up, we failed or whatever. I don't know. We think our God is too small or we think our shortcomings are too big. But our point of view, our perspective is really, really messed up. That you took us out to die. All fear is fear of death in some form. I want you to think about that for a moment. All fear is fear of death in some form. Fear means separation. It might be fear of a relationship dying. It might be a fear of your finances dying. It might be fear of your body dying. It could be fear of some hopes or dreams or some project dying and not coming to fruition. But all fear is fear of death in some form. All of it is. And then they say that you took us to die in the wilderness. What's interesting about this is the fear of this people eventually will be the very thing that does cause them all to die in the wilderness. Because later on, when we get to the book of Numbers, they send spies into the promised land. 12 spies. 10 of them come back with an evil report of the land. Because they're fearful. We're like, there's giants there. I mean, when they went in later, there were no giants. But there are giants there. We're like grasshoppers in our eyes. And we can't go in there. They'll kill our children. And so what does God do? He says, okay, here's what I'm going to do. You are going to die, but you're going to die here in the wilderness. And your children who you're so afraid about, they're going to go in and conquer it. They're going to be great. Eventually, their fear of dying in the wilderness caused them to die in the wilderness. You start fearing something long enough, God will let you have your way. If you have more faith in the things that you fear than you do in the God you're commanded to fear, God will let your things you have faith in come true. Their fear of death would ultimately cause them to die in the wilderness. And that's a story we'll get to in Numbers. And then they say, what is this? What is this? Had they practiced self-control, they'd have known what this is. This is God's plan of salvation for them and destruction of their enemy. But all they could see in it was their own death. That's all they could see. You know, fear makes you stupid. I just want you to know that. The dumbest things I've ever done in my life were things I did when I was in a panic. Like the horse runs into the barn and the barn's on fire. You know, we do dumb stuff when we're afraid. Fear makes us forgetful. They say, what is this? What is this thing going on? Well, remember. Remember everything God has done. He's taken you by the hand. He's done everything perfectly, exactly at the right time. He's proven himself true. He's made promises to you. So can't you trust him right here now? Can't you just trust him right here at this point? But they couldn't. Fear makes us very forgetful. The moment we get afraid, we tend to throw out everything we know about God. We forget his track record. We forget his word and his promises. What is this that you have done to us to take us out of Egypt? Fear causes us to crave security in any form. They would rather go back to living as slaves in Egypt than dying as free men. What it should be, we should fear slavery to the enemy more than death. You have to realize there are things worth dying for. And, you know, the person who's not afraid to die is never afraid of anything. And there are things worth dying for. There are things much worse than death. You know, the people, when they came out here to this place between Pharaoh's army and the sea, they saw two possibilities. They saw only two possibilities. And every time we come to a place of fear, we usually see one of two possibilities. You know, I'm going to drown in the ocean, or I'm going to get hacked to death by Pharaoh's soldiers. Death by drowning. Death by being bloodied up. There's only two possibilities. One of the two is going to happen. But when we look to God, there's always a third that we could never, ever see. Ever. We can never, ever see what he's going to do. I mean, there's not one Israelite that says, you know what, I have this idea. I think if we can talk Moses into sticking his staff out over the water, I bet God will split that water and we will go across between the two walls. I bet. Nobody even could imagine such a thing. But the things God does are things that are far beyond our imagination, because his ways are higher than our ways and his thoughts than our thoughts. He's not limited to our flatland choices. So let's realize that there's always a third option. God just has not revealed it yet. But fear makes us slaves. They were ready to surrender. Take us back. We'll make bricks. We'll make twice as many bricks. You can hold the straw. We're fine. Take us as slaves. And there's a passage in Hebrews 2:15. In Hebrews 2:15, powerful passage. Talks about Messiah's deliverance of us. And it says, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Through fear of death, we're subject to lifelong slavery. And then they said, is this not the statement that we made to you? Let us be, and we will serve Egypt. Now, that's not recorded anywhere. If you go back through the previous chapters of Exodus, there's no place recorded where they said that. Now, they might have said it. They might have said it back in chapter 6, verse 9, right in there when they're complaining to Moses. They might have said it there, but there's no record of it. But fear can make you imagine that you're more wise than your counselors. See, we told you, they didn't, but we told you, we saw this, we're so smart, we're almost prophets. We saw this happening, we told you this is what's going to happen, and here it's happening. Fear can make you so brilliant in your own estimation. But it's really making you stupid. Just downright dumb, stupid. Again, fear makes us slaves. Fear makes us regress. Fear will make us want to go back to our last point of security, no matter how awful and terrible that security was. Fear will keep us from following and moving ahead with God into life. It'll make us regress and want to go back to whatever that security blanket was, no matter how painful and restrictive it was. Fear makes us weak. Now, there's one kind of fear that's the opposite of this. That's fear of God. The only thing we're ever told to fear is God. We're commanded to fear him. And I have found in my life that if I fear God, I don't fear anything else. But if my fear of God begins to lessen, I fear everything. You can't fear both. You can't fear God and then fear all the stuff around you. They said it's better to serve Egypt than to die in the wilderness. Really? I think dying in the wilderness is a lot better than making bricks back in Egypt. Really? Fear limits our vision. We only see two outcomes. They saw serving Egypt, dying in the wilderness, or dying by being hacked to death, or dying by drought. They only saw two options. Fear limits and gives you tunnel vision. I've talked to people in law enforcement and some of the gun classes and things that I've been in. The men will always say, if you ever get in a situation where your life is at stake, and you have to use a firearm, they say, all of a sudden your vision goes from being out here, your periphery vision just disappears and just goes down to a tunnel. And they have to train soldiers and police officers to look around them because fear causes tunnel vision. When that adrenaline starts pumping, peripheral vision goes away. And it's just, time slows down and your vision is constricted to what's right in front of you. You don't see anything else. Fear makes us stupid. I guess I already said that, didn't I? This is what fear does for us. This is what it does to us. And I have some other things in between. I guess I'll go share them because they're on here, but I don't want you to get distracted by this. The voice of fear. This is what the voice of fear does. Insecurity feels painful. We do not like insecurity. This is why we're to find our security not in our job, not in our paycheck, not in our health, not in our relationships. We're to find our security in Him. Because any of these other things we place our security in, they're like the gods of Egypt. God will go on the attack against them. We're making idols out of them. You see, whatever it is you fear, you elevate to the place of God. We're commanded to fear Him and Him alone. And when we fear something else, we're saying, well, this deserves fear as well. So we're taking it and putting it up at the level of God. And God will then have to show us, oh no, that's no God. Let me show you. And He destroys it. Let's be very careful never to fear anything but Him. Because whatever we fear, we elevate to the level of God. It becomes an idol. It becomes something that controls us. And God is a jealous God, and He will destroy it. Don't fear it. The insecurity feels painful. Pain feels like death. And fear of death makes us slaves. Does that all make sense? Can you identify with that? Isn't that the truth? You know, I often listen to talk radio. And more these days, I'm just turning it off. Not that the things they say aren't true. But they see two options all the time. You either have to elect a candidate from this party and things will be great, or you'll elect a candidate from this party and everything goes to hell in a handbasket. And we can start getting very fearful. And then I have to remind myself, God runs the world. You know? I'm still going to be careful how I vote, but God runs the world. Here's the voice of faith. Faith is the opposite of fear. The more your fear increases, the more your faith decreases, and faith casts out fear. All pain is birth pain. You know, when you find the word pain in the Torah for the first time, it's in childbirth. This sets a tone. God's telling us something. All pain you ever experience in your life is some form of birth pain. And new life never comes into this world except through pain. How did you come to Yeshua? How did you become born again? Probably through pain. You had to go do your thing, your way, for a few years, get totally beat up by the world, and finally when you're just bruised and bloodied, you give yourself to Yeshua. That pain was necessary to birth you, to rebirth you. How about some project? Do you ever have inspiration for some great project, whether it's some small thing you're making in the workshop or building a house or building a business? You get this burst of inspiration. It's like, yes, that's what I'm going to do. All right, roll up your sleeves. The pain's coming because between the inspiration and the new life, there's going to be birth pains, period. It's just going to be. It's the way what God has ordained. But all pain is birth pain of some sort. What about physical pain? I broke my foot. Oh, does it hurt? You know what that pain is? That pain is to tell you, don't use the foot. Because it's starting to heal itself. And while it's healing and making itself new, don't use it. That pain is a great gift. Well, how about the pain of death itself? That may be the greatest pain. Ah, but what's on the other side of death? New life. Even dying is birth pain. All pain is birth pain. Birth is new life. Birth is new life. and life is strength and freedom. When you were in the womb, you had no strength, you had no freedom. When you were born, strength began to come on. And later you're crawling, and then walking, and then running, and then jumping and competing. And you are free. All life is strength and freedom. And this is what God wants for us. But remember this. Put this on your bumper. Put it on your refrigerator. Put it somewhere. Fear is illegal for the believer. That's why we are commanded over and over and over and over again. Fear not. Fear not. Do not be afraid. And you know, I look at the places where God would send an angel or he would just show up. And whoever saw the angel or God appeared to them, they'd just freak and they would just fall down on their face. I want you to notice every single time that happens in Scripture, check them all out. Every time it happens, God or the angel or God through the angel would say, stand up and now talk to you. And then he waits. You get control of yourself, conquer your fear, get back on your feet, and then we can talk. Because you see, fear kind of makes you deaf. It makes you deaf. You don't hear. And even when God shows up and we just panic, he waits for us to get back on our feet, stand up, look him in the eyes, and says, now we'll talk. Isn't that amazing? Now, at the end of this Torah portion, we find another enemy revealed. And everything about this other enemy is exactly the opposite of the enemy, Pharaoh and Egypt. This other enemy is Amalek. So what I want us to do is go to the end of the Torah portion. We'll go to chapter 17, and we will pick it up. We'll pick it up in verse 5. Chapter 17 and verse 5. Now, as we look at Amalek and then compare Amalek with Pharaoh and Egypt, I want to tell you right now, here's the thing you must learn. These two enemies represent two spiritual enemies that we have in this life. And there's one kind of tactic that must be used against the one enemy and a completely different tactic used against the other. And I find believers all the time confusing the tactics. They want to use the tactics against Pharaoh, against Amalek, and it doesn't work. And then they want to use the tactics that God gives us for fighting Amalek and apply those to Egypt and Pharaoh. That doesn't work. And it's just a botch, and we get discouraged. Like, I just can't win. We need to recognize our two enemies, and they're pretty stark. They're pretty easy to recognize. And then apply the proper tactics, and we'll walk in victory. I shared during the Torah service, in this Torah portion, we see the people walking through the Red Sea on dry land, and it says the water was like a wall on each side. In fact, in the Torah scroll, it's really interesting. When you get to the Song of the Sea, the way the column is written is completely different. It's just that the line is going across. When you get to the Song of the Sea, and if you want, we can take the Torah scroll out again after the service. Some of you want to come up and see it. When it comes to that section in the Torah scroll, the way they write it is like bricks in a wall. There'll be a line with three chunks of writing, and then a line with two chunks, and then three, then two, then three. So it looks like courses of brick or courses of stone in a wall. Why? Because the water stood like a wall on each side. And last night, Robin, as we were going through the Torah portion, she asked, why does it keep repeating this about the walls on each side, the water standing up like walls? And I didn't know. I said, I don't know. But I love good questions, and I thought about it last night, went to bed thinking about it, woke up this morning thinking about it, and I think I have an answer. And it's this. The dry land was safe, but this wall of water, can you imagine how intimidating that would be? I'm a little freaked out when I go to an aquarium, and they've got the glass, and the water's way up there, and there's this real thick glass between me and the water. Now imagine the water standing up, and there's no glass. And at any moment, that water could just wash over me and destroy me. And over here is another wall of water. I've got death and destruction on both sides of me. But as long as I walk on the dry ground with the pillar of fire and cloud at my back, God at my back, this God of fire and water, as long as I stay on the dry ground, I go straight. I'm fine. And I think God's trying to impress upon us, we walk between two enemies. One on the right, because he's spiritual. One on the left, because it's physical. And they are both there for our destruction and to enslave us and to cause fear. And we need to learn to avoid both. And we walk straight and we'll experience life and victory. So, Amalek. I guess that's given you plenty of time to get to chapter 17, verse 5. Adonai said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and in your hand take your staff with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I shall stand before you by the rock in Horeb. You shall strike the rock, and water will come forth from it, and the people will drink. Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He called the place Massa Umeribah. Massa means quarreling. Meribah means testing, because of the quarreling of the children of Israel and because of their test of the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now that's a dumb, dumb question. That's probably the dumbest question in the entire Bible right there. Right now I'm putting that at the top of the list of dumb questions in the Bible that people ask. It has to be number one. I can't imagine a dumber question. But look at the very next word. Amalek came and battled Israel in Rephidim, or Rephidim. Immediately, there's no leading up. No, back in Pharaoh, they could see the Pharaoh's army coming. They had a lot of time to panic and figure out just how they're going to all suffer and die in no time. But with Amalek's there, kaboom. He just attacks. And it says it takes place in Rephidim. People have tried to figure out what Rephidim means, and one of the rabbis says that Rephidim is a contraction for Rafu Yadehem. They loosened their hands. They loosened their grip. And when we loosen our grip on who God is and of his constant presence and watch care over us, the moment we do that, Amalek hits. He will hit us right, I mean, just like lightning out of the sky. It will hit and take your breath away. It's such a shock. And he does it all the time. The moment we begin to question, is God with me? Is he really here? And boom, there's Amalek. What does Amalek mean? The name Amalek means people, Alek. That's where we get our word lick. People of licking up. The people of licking up. They are the worst of the worst. Of all the enemies of Israel, Amalek is the worst. I can imagine I have a wild imagination. I just picture these people just almost barbaric, almost like animals covered with mud and just, you know, eating soup with their fingers and just no manners at all. Moses said to Joshua, and this is the first time Joshua's name is mentioned in the Bible, right here. Joshua, which is Yahashua. It's the same name as Yeshua, Jesus. Choose people for us and go do battle with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Joshua did as Moses said to him to do battle with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur ascended to the top of the hill. Now, got the picture? Here's Moses at the top of the hill. And you've got Aaron on one side and Hur on the other. And it happened when Moses raised his hand, he's holding the staff. When Moses raised his hand, Israel was stronger. And when he lowered his hand, Amalek was stronger. Interesting choice of words. Didn't say when he raised his hand that Israel was stronger. When he lowered it, Israel got weaker. It says when he lowered his hand, Amalek got stronger. If you want Amalek in your life to be weak, you have to hold up the hands of Moses, the staff of Moses, the Torah of Moses. It's a tree of life for those who grasp it, and all its supporters are praiseworthy. It happened when Moses raised his hand, Israel was stronger. When he lowered his hand, Amalek was stronger. Moses' hands grew heavy. So they took a stone, put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on this side, one on that side. And he remained with his hands faithful. That's what the word is in Hebrew. Amunah. It was faithful until sunset. Joshua weakened Amalek and its people with a sword blade. Notice it doesn't say he defeated him. Doesn't say he destroyed him. Doesn't say Amalek's nothing to worry about anymore. It says he weakened him. Now, these next three verses are very interesting. Now, look how odd they are. The Lord said to Moses, write this as a remembrance in the book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I shall surely erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Got it? God says, I will, you can take it to the bank, I will surely erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. In fact, when a Torah scribe is getting ready to write out a Torah scroll, it's all done with a quill pen, and he dips it in the ink, and he writes, and dips it in the ink, and writes. Whenever he makes a new pen, he sharpens the point on the quill feather. When he makes a new pen, to test that pen, he gets a scrap piece of parchment. He writes the name Amalek and then X's it out. Isn't that cool? So he says, I will surely erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Moses built an altar, called his name Adonai Nisi. The Lord is my miracle, or the Lord is my banner. The word Nis means banner or miracle. It means both. And he said, for a hand is on the throne of God. Adonai maintains a war against Amalek from generation to generation. All right. You see the inconsistency here? He says, take it to the bank. I'm going to eradicate the name of Amalek from off the earth, and you'll fight them generation after generation after generation after generation. It goes on and on and on and on. Well, which is it? Are you going to erase them and eradicate them, or do we fight them forever? Or at least as long as we're generating new generations? The answer is yes. As long as human beings are walking in this world, in this fallen world, we will battle Amalek. It's an ongoing war. It's not like with Pharaoh in Egypt where it's done. They're not even an item anymore. Amalek goes on generation after generation, but God says, I will eradicate their name from the earth. What do these two enemies represent in our lives? I can't stress how important this is I'm about to show you. Because these two enemies, Amalek, and we don't have a name of a king of Amalek here, just Amalek, just the people of Amalek. But with Egypt, we have Egypt, and we have the name of the king, which is Pharaoh. These two groups represent the enemies in your life. They're out to destroy you. They're like the walls of water that could come crushing down on you. Stay on the dry ground. Learn how to defeat both of them. Learn how to work against both of them. Learn the tactics. Here's what they are. You'll notice that when it comes to Egypt and Pharaoh, who does the fighting? God does. He does all of it. They don't have to lift a single finger to do anything. All they have to do is walk forward. God deals with Pharaoh. God deals with Egypt. We don't have to do a single thing. You got it? And when you try to fight Pharaoh, when you try to fight Egypt, you lose. You let God fight this one. Because this enemy is a totally, absolutely, completely spiritual enemy. But Amalek, the people did all the fighting. God didn't do any of it. The people fight. Our problem is we want God to fight Amalek for us. And we pray and pray and pray and pray against Amalek in our lives, and nothing happens. We just keep getting beat up. We keep losing. But we're ready to go fight Pharaoh and fight Egypt, and we keep losing. Let's use the right tactics. Now, I haven't told you who these enemies are, but here they are. Pharaoh represents Satan. Egypt represents his kingdom. And all of us, before we came to the Lord, before the blood of the Passover lamb was applied to the doors of our lives, we were slaves to this group. We were slaves. All right? We were facing continued slavery and death. God, through the blood of the Lamb, passed us from death to life, and by the body of the Lamb, passed us from slavery to freedom. And those guys are done with. They're done. Nothing left to do. There's nothing left for you to do when it comes to Satan and his kingdom. The battle is won. God has dealt with it. But the thing is, as you go through the story of Israel, in fact, even in this portion, they saw the horse and the rider washed up on the shores of the sea. They're dead. They're gone. And God says, you will never, ever, ever, ever see them again. Take a look now, because you'll never see them again. It's done. And it says, and they saw them dead, kaput. And yet, through the rest of this portion, and the next, and the next, and the next, all through the Torah, all the time, Pharaoh's in their heads. And they keep wanting to go back. And they can't, but they want to go back. Oh, we remember the leeks, garlic, and onions. That comes up. We remember the leeks, garlic, and onions of Egypt. Oh, how we ate over there. We remember the flesh pots. Oh, how wonderful it was. Oh, if only we just stayed slaves in Egypt. Better than this stuff in the wilderness. We're getting tired of this manna. And all the time, when things get tough, Pharaoh and his army, and it's done away with, they want to go back. And they can't. It's gone. It's all in their heads. This enemy, the war is all in your brain. It's all there. That's where the battlefield is. He's a defeated enemy, a destroyed enemy. He has no physical power over you. And in fact, it tells us that Satan can't even touch you. Can't touch you. But he's in our heads. Because all he has are lies. What are lies? Lies are things that are not real. Reality is truth. Non-reality is a lie. And Pharaoh, our Pharaoh, Satan, attacks us all the time with lies. Things that have no reality to them. Now, don't get me wrong. There is definitely a Satan. And he has a kingdom. But he's a serpent and his only weapon is his mouth. And he's very skillful at using lies. And this is why Messiah says in John 8:31, if you continue in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. We fight Satan not by out-yelling him. We fight him by out-truthing him. Because he's a defeated foe. He's done. He's kaput. Amalek, on the other hand, the people of looking up, we battle all the time. Because this is very physical. In fact, Amalek is your flesh. It's this stuff. It's this animal flesh with its desires, with its drives, with its lust. And it has strong desires that are contrary to God's spirit. And your spirit has desires that are contrary to the flesh. And this we constantly, generation after generation after generation, we fight against this. We do the fighting. We do the warfare, but we have a very specific way to do it. Let's go on and compare this some more. And notice, too, that Egypt, it names their king. Amalek doesn't name a king. Satan's kingdom has Satan as the king. But Amalek is just the flesh. It's just the stuff, isn't it? You know, if we follow it, it will turn us into animals and we become the people of licking up. You know, what does it say about, how did God punish the serpent? It says, you'll go on your belly and you'll eat the dust of the earth. That'll be your food. And we know that when we die, we go back to dust. So the enemy's food is just death. And his weapon is deception and lies to cause us to live in fear. But in the meantime, this dust is flesh, and it is my enemy if I submit to it. It'll turn me into an animal. It'll turn me into a people of licking up. The amazing thing about human beings, this is what makes us different from animals. A dog is a dog is a dog. You can train it to do tricks, but it's born a dog, lives a dog, dies a dog. It's always be a dog. And that's fine. That's what it's programmed to be. An angel is an angel. But human beings, we can become animals, or we can become more like angels. We can become more like God, I should say. We can go this way and we can go that way. And at any moment, at any time, we can turn around and reverse direction. We're always moving to become more like God, or we're just slipping back, becoming more like an animal. All the time. It's an ongoing battle. Egypt and Pharaoh are past masters. They will never be slave masters again, even though in their brains the people still thought of themselves fondly as slaves of Pharaoh. But Amalek would be their master. Pharaoh and Egypt are already defeated, but Amalek's an ongoing warfare. Egypt and Pharaoh, the enemy is behind, right? And God stood in the pillar of cloud and fire, and he stood so that the enemy couldn't get closer. And the people went on ahead, he stayed behind, God destroyed them. It's back, it's gone, it's in the past. But Amalek, everywhere they went, it was on the attack. It was in front of them and constantly came after them. Egypt and Pharaoh, there was no relationship between the Israelites and the Egyptians. But Amalek, they were cousins. These were children of Edom, Esau. Remember Edom? The guy who's red and hairy, a man of the field. He loves to trap and kill and eat. I mean, he's just a man of physical appetites. These are his children. These are cousins of Israel. In other words, there's a close relationship with this stuff that I wear. Egypt and Pharaoh desire total destruction. But Amalek, according to the histories and the legends of Israel, continued to exploit weaknesses. They would attack the camp for anyone who was weak, lagging behind, strained a little bit, they'd go and grab them. What does God tell the people to do when it comes to Pharaoh and Egypt? Stand. Don't be afraid. Stand still. Behold the salvation of the Lord. Keep your mouth shut. Those are the four things he tells me to do. Just stand. Just watch what I'm doing. There's nothing for you to do here except stand. Don't be afraid. Stand. Stay put. I'll do all the fighting for you. You just stand there. What we want to do, we want to go on the attack against the enemy. And you know, there's some ministries that are completely founded on beating up the devil. And I know I've said this before, but I want to share it again. I believe in the demonic. I've seen the demonic. I've heard the demonic speak through the mouths of people. I've seen their faces completely change. I've seen their personalities change when the demon comes on them. And I've seen the transformation of their personalities when the demon leaves. So I know about the demonic. I believe in it. I've seen it. I wouldn't cross the street to see another one. And I know Hollywood wants us to be afraid, very afraid of the demonic. And it promotes movies and so on that makes the demonic look like this thing we should be absolutely terrified of. And I'll tell you what, let me just show you. I could make a movie about the demonic. What I would show is some rotting garbage and show flies buzzing around. Now, does that cause terror? No, just disgust. But no terror. I'm not afraid of house flies. Don't like them. They're germy. Don't want anything to do with them. But I don't run screaming in terror away from them. And how do I get rid of the house flies? You got demonic activity in your life, here's how you get rid of it. Get rid of the garbage. You know, and too many ministries are fly swatting ministries. They want to go and kill the demons, but they don't have the people get the garbage out of their lives. When people come to me, they sometimes have obvious demonic problems. And so I don't start trying to cast demons out of them. I just say, here's some garbage, toss it. Repent, get the garbage out. You do that, flies are easy to deal with. But as long as there's garbage in your life, they have rights there. So why should I wear myself out swatting flies? They're just going to keep coming back and coming back. You understand? So, don't watch the Hollywood movies. You want to know about the demonic? Just don't wash your dishes. Just leave them there and you'll get an object lesson. Pharaoh in Egypt, they're an internal enemy. Literally, they were an internal enemy to Israel. Because they didn't exist anymore, but the memories did. The memories kept luring them back. And when everything, like I said, whenever anything got tough, oh, let's go back to Egypt. Oh, Egypt was so wonderful. And what happens is that the enemy in our lives, when this redeemed life that we walk starts to get boring or difficult or confusing in any way, we start thinking about something in our past that enslaved us, but all we can remember is the pleasure, maybe the camaraderie that sin brought us, maybe the admiration that sin brought us. And we remember that. We don't remember the shame. We don't remember the death, the ill health, the expense, and the destruction it brought. But it's all in the brain. It's all in the brain, all in the mind. Amalek, though, is right out here. I can see it. Now, it's not that your bodies are evil. Just to make sure we understand this. These are the tabernacles of your spirit. But remember, the tabernacle was all made out of dead stuff. Hides and skins and cloth, wood that used to be a live tree, it's just now a dead tree, and plants that were woven into fibers, it was made out of metal. None of the tabernacle had life in it, it was just dead stuff, but it was brought into proper order and it was filled with God's Spirit. So as long as I'm walking in the Spirit, I will not fulfill the lust of this. It serves me, I don't serve it. But the moment I quit walking in God's Spirit, Amalek attacks. When my grip weakens on the truth, when my grip weakens on who God is, Amalek attacks. Kaboom, there he is. He's ready to come after me. Pharaoh and Egypt are a continuing battle in the mind, but Amalek is a continuing battle in the flesh. The enemy's tactics, when it comes to Pharaoh and Egypt, he uses falsehood and fear. Now, when it came to Amalek, notice fear is not mentioned. In the battle of Amalek, no fear mentioned. These people have been afraid of everything so far. It doesn't mention any fear of Amalek. Our problem, we should like Amalek a little too much. No, Amalek's tactics are doubt and treachery. And there's no Hebrew word in the Bible for doubt. You know, the only words used in the Hebrew scriptures are words that are real things. In fact, there's a rule in Judaism that if a word is not found in the Torah or in the Hebrew scripture somewhere, then that thing is not really real. It has no enduring qualities. It has nothing that really lasts for eternity or even whose memory has any power or anything for eternity. Is it real? And in the Bible, though there are Hebrew words for doubt, you'll never find that word doubt in the Hebrew scriptures. The word doubt never appears in the Hebrew scriptures, nowhere. But what's interesting, the numerical value of the Hebrew word for doubt and the numerical value for Amalek are the same value. They're the same number. The word Amalek has a value of 240. And the word for doubt is Suffolk. And Suffolk has a value of 240. Because Amalek, his power is doubt. And the moment you begin to doubt, is God really with me or not? All of a sudden the flesh says, you know what? You know what? Let's go do, and fill in the blank. The defense against Satan is truth. The defense against Amalek is obedience. You want to know what walking in the Spirit is? It's obeying God's word. How did they defeat Amalek? Moses is holding up the staff. That's a picture of Torah. And long as Torah is lifted up, long as Torah is held high, God's commandments, his promises, his covenants, and the Torah is what we live by, we're going to be okay against the flesh. We're going to do all right. We're going to do just fine. Because when we lift up the Torah and walk in the Torah, we're walking in the Spirit, because Paul says that the Torah is spiritual and it's good and it's holy. Holy and spiritual and good. You have any idea how effective the enemy has been against the church? Against good, God-fearing people who love God, who love Yeshua, but he's deceived them into thinking, oh, those first five books of Moses, you don't need that. And then you wonder why the church is so fleshly today. And every time there's a Christian celebrity, it's just a matter of just watch the calendar, he's going to fall. And usually he does. And it's always to the flesh, always to the flesh. Why is it so many pastors and good Christian people, all of us know them, have fallen flat on their faces because of lust and of the flesh, of Amalek being destructive in their lives? It's because they've ignored the weapon God has given them against Amalek. Can't emphasize that enough. Just can't emphasize that enough. So, usually the case is, you're going to conquer both of these enemies, or you're going to conquer neither of these enemies. It's usually the way it works. Because they do work in tandem. And you're falling for one, you fall for the other. And it's the attack of one that can cause us to weaken and then be attacked by the other. But do you understand these two enemies? Do you understand how powerful they are? Do you understand how little power they have? We walk in the truth. And if we're walking in obedience to the word, they're powerless. No power whatsoever. None. Zip. Zero. Zilch. Nada. None. I'm going to take just a couple of minutes and show you a couple of things that are really important. These are things you will not see in the Hebrew, or see in your translations, but they're there in the Hebrew. And they're very obvious. If you ever study Psalm 145, and we often read it in prayer services and so on, Psalm 145 is an acrostic psalm. The first verse starts with Aleph. Second verse starts with Beit. Third verse starts with Gimel. And this is a wonderful psalm. It goes through the Hebrew alphabet in order and proclaims God's conquering power, his goodness, his provision. It's a wonderful, beautiful, incredible psalm, Psalm 145. So if you're going through and you're watching the Hebrew, first verse Aleph, second verse Beit, Gimel, Dalet, Hei, Vav, you just go right on through. The 14th verse should start with the letter Nun. That's the letter Nun. You spell it like Nun, N-U-N. But when you get to the 14th verse, which should start with that letter, it doesn't start with that letter. It skips that letter and goes to the next letter. That letter is omitted. Why? When David wrote this psalm, he knew the alphabet. And when he omitted this, he knew he omitted it. Because all he had to do is look, oh, I've only got 21 verses and there are 22 letters. I'm missing one somewhere. But he didn't. He left it out on purpose. Nun is a bent letter. It's bowed over. And in Jewish lore, Hebrew lore, Nun always represents that which is bent and that which is falling. And that letter is omitted. Now the next letter in the alphabet is the letter Samek. The letter Samek. Looks like that. And it's spelled S-A-M-E-C-H. Samek. And the word Samek means support. Means to uphold. And so the 14th verse, which should start with Nun, starts with Samek, and listen to what the verse says. Psalm 145, verse 14. The Lord supports all who fall and raises up all who are bowed down. Got it? Here's what it says in Hebrew. The very first word of the verse is Somech, support. That's the name of the letter. Somech Adonai lechol ha-noflim. Noflim starts with none, the fallen ones. So he supports the noflim, which starts with the word none. V'zokef lechol ha-kfufim. And raises up all who are just bent over. Now, why am I bringing out these two letters? When you put these two letters together, Nun and Samek, it spells the word Nes, which means miracle. And there in the last chapter of what we read, verse 15, it says, Moses built an altar and called its name Adonai Nisi, Adonai, my miracle. See, every miracle God does is an act of supporting the fallen, straightening the bent, taking those who are just about to collapse, that's us, and holding us up. This is why there's not a verse that starts with none in that psalm. The word that starts with none, no flim, is folded in to the verse that starts with Samek, support. Somech Adonai kol hanofilim. This letter is folded in to the letter that's strong and supporting. But this word nes also means banner. Because you see, when we allow God to operate in our lives and support us, to straighten us out, that's our banner. His hand in our life is the banner over us. So what is his banner over us? His banner over us is love. Because everything he does, his support of us, his straightening of us, of making us stand strong, that is his love for us. Now what's interesting, whenever the letter nun comes at the end of a word, it changes shape. It looks like this. It gets tall and strong and straight. It's got a little bit of a blip on top, but it's this long, tall, straight letter, because that is the outcome of those who allow God to support them, to do the miracle of support in their lives and be a banner to them. And you know how we learn to get supported by God? We learn to be supported by God through Nun Samech Hey. That spells Nasa. But that's how it's pronounced. What does Nasa mean? It means testing. Did you notice the miracles in this passage? Parting the Red Sea, sweetening the bitter waters, bringing quail and manna down from heaven, striking a rock that gives water. Every nace, every miracle followed a nasa, a testing. Testing has a very, very powerful influence in our lives. I should put it this way. Failure has a very powerful effect in our lives, because failure destroys our egos. Failure destroys our self-sufficiency. Failure chips away at our phantom souls that we want to project off to people. This is who we are. It's not who we are. We're afraid people will see who we are. And God brings testing, allows us to fail, and he chips it away. This is why he didn't criticize the people when they failed. Because he's using those failures to chip away at them. It's when they said, oh, is God with us or not? I mean, come on, is he really with us? That's when he got ticked and Amalek attacked. Just because you fail doesn't mean God's with you. It means God is with you. He's probably allowing you to fail a test to chip away at that ego of yours, because that thing's smothering you. But don't ever ask if he's with you or not. Maybe ask, am I with him or not? That's okay. And then at the very end of the chapter, there's this cryptic verse, and we'll close with this. And it says in verse 15, Moses built an altar and called its name Adonai Nisi. And he said, for a hand is on the throne of God. And in Hebrew, throne of God is written this way. It's written, Kes Yud Hey. Both words are misspelled. They're not spelled complete. This should be Kesi. There should be a Yud at the end of this word. And this is supposed to be God's name, Yud Hey, Vav Hey. The Vav and Hey are left off. Why are these two words spelled incompletely? And the sages have written about this in great detail, and this brilliant insight they have. They say, as long as we are falling to Amalek, God's name fails to be formed in our lives, and his throne fails to appear in our lives. But when we defeat our enemies, his throne appears and his name is completed. You see, the last half of God's name, I'll put a little dash here, looks like the first half, except the Yud is extended down as a Vav, and there's another Hey. The last half looks like the first half. But the first half can be used for God's name, but the second half represents us imitating him. It means that God's Spirit has descended into our lives, and we are imitating and listening to what he's doing. The first part of his name represents who he is in his Torah. The second half of his name represents us bringing that down to earth, living out his Torah in this world, and then God's name, Yad Heh Vav Heh, is completed. There's a wonderful passage in Psalms where we find throne of the Lord spelled out in full. It's the only other place, and it's spelled out fully there. And it is in Psalm 9, verses 5 through 7. I'll start with 5, but 7 is what contains the throne of the Lord. Listen to what it says. You have rebuked the nations. You have made the wicked perish. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. You notice who he's talking about? Egypt and Amalek, right? The enemy came to an end in everlasting ruins. Their cities you rooted out. The very memory of them has perished. Again, Egypt and Amalek. And then here's the verse, verse 7. But Adonai, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, spelled fully, sits enthroned. Kesey. It's spelled out fully. But Adonai sits enthroned forever. He has established his throne for justice. When those enemies are destroyed in our lives, God's throne and his name are fully displayed. It's powerful, powerful insight. So we have enemies. Use the right tactics against the right enemy. One enemy's internal, it's in our brains. It's all lies. The other enemy is this one out here. It's the flesh. And the moment we begin to doubt and lose our grip on who God is and who he is to us, how close he is, then the flesh rises up to entertain us. Those are our enemies. It's just that simple. God fought the one, and we continue to maintain victory through truth. We fight the other, we maintain victory through obedience to this. You got it? I guess I could have just said that at the beginning and skipped the whole teaching, but. Well, this is what we're going to do. Let's close our eyes. We're going to close in prayer. But for prayer, as we were going through the prayer service this morning, this stood out to me, so we're going to make this our closing prayer. It comes from our Siddur. It's very short. And it says, Adonai Elohechem Emet, the Lord your God is true. True and standing firm and established and enduring and upright and faithful and beloved and adored and cherished and pleasant and awesome and mighty and affixed and received and good and beautiful is this word for us forever. The eternal God is true, our King, the rock of Jacob, shield of our salvation. From generation to generation, he endures, and his name endures, and his throne is established, and his kingdom and his faithfulness forever endure. And his words live and endure, faithful and cherished forever and for all eternity, for our fathers and for us. For our children and for our generations and for all generations of the offspring of Israel, your servants. For the first and for the last is a good word. It endures forever and ever. It is a true and faithful statute which will not pass away. It is true that you are Adonai our God and the God of our fathers, our King and the King of our fathers, our Redeemer and the Redeemer of our fathers, the one who formed us, the rock of our Yeshua, our ransomer and rescuer is your name from long ago. There is no God except you. Amen.